This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, it's Kaveh. Real quick, before we get started with the show, I just want to make sure I get all the plugs right away because it's very important to me. First of all, thank you to Nadim for help with production. Appreciate it, buddy. Show would not be happening without you. Next, our co-host today, Mark Gasway, great musician. You've heard me talk about him before. You can find his music pretty much anywhere you find music, Spotify, YouTube, etc. You can go to his website, markgasway.com. It's Mark with a C. Or better yet, if you're in the LA area, watch him play at the Varnish. That's a club where he kind of manages the music there. Or you can watch him at a place called the Descanso Botanical Gardens. I've never been there, but it sounds beautiful. And the cool thing about that is on the 23rd, he's going to be doing a slack key guitar performance from 4 to 6. And slack key guitar is a really fun, cool type of music. And if you haven't heard it, I recommend going, checking it out, saying hi. Lastly, this episode is brought to you by Lucky Dog Hot Sauces, the maker of my favorite hot sauces. Check out their latest stuff, the Year of the Dog. It's delicious. I highly recommend it. And if you haven't, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. I really appreciate that. I read them, I enjoy reading them, and I will likely also read it on air. Anyways, enjoy the show. You guys ready? Are you guys excited? Yeah, okay, good. And welcome back to the House of Pod. My name is Kaveh. I'll be your host for this little humor-adjacent medical podcast. I am a doctor, I should mention that. I don't think I ever have in any of the 188 episodes before this. But I was told I should mention that I am also a medical doctor. That might be of interest to the listeners.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt with a question before
Please. My thoughts
have been introduced.
Before we tell you,
are there non-medical doctor gastroenterologists walking around out there?
Did I mention that I was a gastroenterologist? I didn't say that. I mean,
no, you spoiled it, Gasway.
I'm a gastroenterologist. There's two voices you've heard, and I'm going to introduce both of them right now before the show goes completely off the rails. First, returning guest,
it's doomed.
Returning guest co-host Mark Gasway, musician. All around beautiful mammal living in Los Angeles. Mark, welcome back to the show.
How's it going, party people?
Joining us today to talk about a lot of stuff, including pathology. We're going to talk about pathology. Is someone that you know very well. I didn't know until recently, but I'm very happy to have gotten to know this individual. And we're going to talk about how we all know each other. Dr. Jason Rosenbaum. He's the medical director of the Kaiser Permanente Northern California Genomics Lab. He is a molecular pathologist. Dr. Rosenbaum, can I call you Jason?
Please.
Can I call you Jace?
No. No, you cannot do that.
Jason? Hey, buddy, did I get your credentials right?
Yeah, yeah. Notably, though, you mentioned that Mark is a mammal. You didn't describe any order of Linnaean taxonomy to me.
Yeah, you're a plant. Oh.
Indeed, indeed.
I will say, Jason, that Kaveh and I spent a certain amount of time debating whether we were going to refer to you throughout the course of the episode as variably Dr. Rosenbaum, Dr. Rosen Rosen, Dr. Rosen, but we weren't at all confident that enough people had seen the movie Fletch and would maybe think that
they wouldn't get it. They would
think it was anti-Semitic.
Exactly right. They would hear an Iranian guy saying weird anti-Semitic shit, and that would be the end of this podcast. So we decided against that route, but just know in our heart that we're making fun of you.
Okay. I basically make that assumption all the time. Notably, I picked up the Fletch books recently, and they're actually pretty good.
I heard the new John Hamm like reboot is closer to it and supposed to be very good as well. I've not seen it.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
different sort of thing. But,
I mean, I should note that 99% of this audience is too young to have seen the Fletch movies and probably has no interest in watching the John Hamm reboot. So they have no idea what the fuck we're talking about right now.
What do you mean they're too young
for that right there?
What's that? What happened?
You dropped your first F-bomb on that?
Oh, no. I'm surprised it's taken that long for me to drop one.
We're still in PG-13. You say one more. This podcast is now rated R.
If you're listening to this with your kids in the car, I'm sorry. I do apologize. But you should have known better at this point. You should know better than to do that with your kids in the car.
Be responsible and put the car seat on the roof while you're listening to the podcast.
Yeah. Animals. So let's get to some very basics of how we all know each other. Mark and I met at Berkeley when we were undergrads, and we've been friends since then. You knew Mark back then in Berkeley as well.
Yes.
I did not know you then, but you were friends with Mark. And then later in life, Mark introduced you and me. And then we became friends. We're friends, right? I think we're friends. Aren't we friends, Jason?
Yeah,
Jason?
I think it's the transitive property of friendship.
Yeah. Yeah, and you were the editor of something called the Heuristic Squelch. Now, can you explain what that is to people who are not from Berkeley?
Sure. The Heuristic Squelch is the modern version of UC Berkeley's humor magazine. Older alumni may be more familiar with a rag called the Pelican, which was around for a long time. But then I think sometime in the late 80s, the Heuristic Squelch popped up as a bit more alternative. I think the Pelican had gone away a few years before that. And so it was a student-run humor magazine. I just got in as sort of a hobby, you know, something to pass the time. And then pretty quickly, actually, during my freshman or sophomore year, things sort of fell apart administratively with the Squelch. And it was up to a couple of us to sort of pull things together and make sure it lived on. And so one of those people was me, and one of those people was a mutual friend of Mark's and mine. And so we sort of rebuilt the Squelch. I was the editor in chief, and Mark was sort of a satellite character around the Squelch. I don't think, Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you ever actually wrote an article per se, but I know you attended meetings and contributed jokes here and there.
I never wrote anything that was published. I submitted, but I wasn't funny enough.
God, that's fucking brutal. This is good. This could go to some weird places that I'm not going to take it to, but I just want the listeners out there to know I hear it too.
I will say this, the heuristic squelch was, and I'm assuming still is, it was hilarious. I didn't know you at the time, Jason, but when Mark said, hey, you know this guy that is also a doctor that is on Twitter as well, you know, he used to be the editor of the Squelch. It gave you automatic cred in my mind because I was like, the Squelch was so fucking funny. It, for our listeners out there, it was essentially, similar. I mean, there's a lot of similarities, don't you think, between the heuristic Squelch and the Onion, right?
Yeah, I think so. It was a little less directly parodying news. There was a little more sort of flexibility in our format than the Onion has or had even at that time. But it was basically the same idea, at least at that time. You know, at that time, the Onion was just, the internet hadn't happened yet. If we can all date ourselves now, I was at Berkeley from 94 to 98. And the internet was just sort of coming into its own right about then. And so the Onion wasn't the Onion. The Onion was basically what we were doing just at the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Very similar. Like I said, we were a little bit more flexible with formats. We did a little bit more of like parodies of television shows and things like that the Onion didn't really do. But very similar idea, to the Harvard Lampoon. A lot of colleges have magazines like that, yeah.
This is something that I'm embarrassed to ask, but what does heuristic squelch mean? What does the title mean?
So a heuristic, I was not part of naming the magazine, but heuristic is a sort of intellectual device, an intellectual model you use to teach somebody something. And a squelch is basically the squawky noise you get on a CB radio. And I think the people that named it just thought they were two funny words to put together. I don't know that there was much more to it than that.
I think heuristic is like a learning system where it's like heuristic versus algorithmic. Where like,
yeah, right.
Algorithm is like you follow a process in order to work through things, and heuristic is kind of like you teach yourself by trial and error or something like that.
All right. So just two funny words put together. I get it. Okay. So you had this writing background, you were doing the comedy fun mm-hmm. stuff, and then you decide to become a doctor.
Decide is sort of overstating it.
You were drafted.
I always wanted to be a scientist. I was heavily committed to biology. At Berkeley, I did a combined evolutionary biology and molecular biology degree. And my honors thesis project was to put together and describe a small dinosaur that had been collected and stored at the University of California Museum of Paleontology for something like 15 years, and just nobody had looked at it. So that was my deal. I ended up going to medical school as part of the MD-PhD program, because I thought that I would get a sort of more holistic understanding of biology by doing that. Your listeners may know, or they may not know, when you do a PhD, especially a molecular biology PhD, it's very narrow. You're often focused on maybe one molecule in one organ system, in one species. So maybe you focus on a specific gene in flies or something like that. And that seemed too kind of narrow for what I wanted to do. So I applied to an MD-PhD program. I was accepted. And then the PhD really didn't work out very well for me. And so I ended up treating the MD as kind of a fallback. And I ended up completing the MD and going into pathology and then finally molecular pathology.
Before we get into molecular pathology, I want to just sort of talk about pathology. Like, I don't know if a lot of people know what that really means. I don't know if a lot of doctors really know what pathologists do, to be completely honest with you. Mark, let me just start by asking you a question here. What do you think a pathologist does?
My recollection, I don't know if you knew this about me, actually, by the way. When I was in high school, I had a summer job as a surgical orderly.
I did not know that.
Yeah, at Tarzana Regional Medical Center, which became Providence Medical in Tarzana years later. And my recollection of what the pathology guy was is that, you know, there'd be like a biopsy. Somebody would take like, you know, a piece of somebody's, you know, tissue and then put it in like a Petri dish. And the pathology guy was the guy that like they'd send it to, and he would kind of analyze that piece for things.
Okay. So how did he do there, Jason?
He captured a lot of it. That's not a bad sort of summary of at least a part of pathology. That's the part of pathology that we would describe as anatomic pathology. That's when you use a microscope to look at tissue. Mm-hmm. And so Mark just described what a surgical pathologist does. A lot of looking at biopsies, a lot of looking at tumors, things like that. Also part of anatomic pathology are forensic pathologists, so people that do autopsies for a living. And so that's where you get your CSI and your Marcus Welby for those that are even, you know, 90. older than us.
Sure. So there's a difference between molecular pathologist and surgical pathologist. The pathologists who are looking at like genetics, like you,
sure,
versus people who are looking at tissue samples from like a surgery or something like that.
The way I describe it to people outside of medicine, you know, the so-called Thanksgiving dinner conversation, is anytime your doctor says, "We're waiting for the lab," you're waiting for a pathologist, basically. And so, and really, pathology encompasses all the things we just talked about, but also any kind of blood test, receiving blood from the blood bank, genetic testing, which is what I do, all that is covered by pathology. Some estimates have put roughly 70% of medical decisions rely on data supplied by a pathologist, ultimately.
You guys are incredibly important in the medical process. I can say that as someone who does procedures and takes biopsies. It's a massive part of the process. Let me ask you this, though. Until I met you, I had not really understood the concept of there being different types of pathologists. I didn't know that there was like, you know, the molecular guys working on the genetic levels versus like the surgical guys that I think I'm probably more used to working with.
Yeah,
in the world of pathology, are the surgical pathologists kind of like the jocks and like the molecular pathologists kind of like the nerds?
I don't know. I mean, there are certainly, just as there are in medicine and out in the world, there are stereotypes, and some of them, you know, ring true for better or worse. I think the forensic pathologists tend to have a reputation as being a little odd.
It's a bit morbid. It's a bit, you're dealing
it's a
with,
bit, you're, it's a bit those morbid,
are the,
yeah.
Those are the people, like, are they coroners? Forensic pathologist, or do you have to be a pathologist to be a coroner, or is that
different? It depends on the state. The state regulations, the state laws sort of dictate who is a coroner and who isn't.
So some states could just let Mark be like a coroner. Mark's in.
No state would let Mark be a coroner.
Right. Okay. Florida might.
Florida.
Let's be fair.
Yeah, so the forensic pathologists do have maybe a little bit of a reputation for being odd in different ways. I don't know that surgical pathologists have any particular reputation. I mean, those of us that are in medicine, we all sort of know the reputation for pathologists generally as being somewhat introverted and maybe not that interested in interacting with people, I guess. There's probably, you know, there's probably some underlying truth to that, although I would say it's overstated a bit. I don't think there are any sort of cowboy or rock star groups in pathology. I would say
can I tell you, I love the concept of there being amongst pathologists, like certain pathologists who think they're a lot cooler than the other pathologists. I think that would be awesome.
Yeah. I mean, there are differences, though. I mean, molecular pathology in particular is a very new field. And so I have found it to be somewhat more diverse than other parts of pathology and other parts of medicine. More maybe interested in innovation. We're in molecular pathology, as you might imagine, you know, genetics evolves constantly. And so we're really all the time thinking about how to test new things, how to integrate new ideas into our practice. It's nonstop. And so that part is really fun. You may remember a couple years ago, there was a big new virus that started spreading.
Nothing. It's not ringing a bell.
There was.
Sure. I guess if you say so.
I mean, and that was a big deal for molecular pathology because you know, viruses are made up of nucleic acid, and so all the testing that wasn't happening and then all of a sudden did happen. A lot of the development of that fell on the shoulders of molecular pathologists and microbiologists, who are also part of the pathology continuum. Personally, I didn't get really elbow deep in all of that. I was peripherally involved in developing some COVID testing right at the beginning, but it was a big deal. It was a big deal for the field, a big chance to step up. I don't want to say it was exciting exactly. That's not the right way to frame it, but it was definitely a different environment for molecular pathology than what we typically do.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm glad it was all worth it then.
So. May I ask a question? Is it fair to say that surgical pathology is like you get tissue and so you give informed advice about how to fix the tissue or what's wrong with the tissue, whereas molecular pathology is like more about how you design a medication to treat? You're making the face.
Yeah, well, so all of pathology, I shouldn't say all, but most of pathology is diagnostic. And so the surgical pathologists, for the most part, are taking a patient's tissue and looking at it under the microscope and maybe applying some specific techniques in order to cause some things to be more visible. But at the end of the day, what they're doing is looking at it and saying, this is the diagnosis. And possibly, you know, we see metastasis or we don't see metastasis. We see invasion of other tissues or we don't see invasion. Molecular pathology is looking at the genetic makeup of either the person themselves or the cancer and looking for In some cases, markers of diagnosis. So if you were, say, getting a test for cystic fibrosis or sickle cell anemia, those tests are all done in a molecular pathology lab. If a person has cancer, you may be familiar with a lot of the advertising you see during sporting events for targeted therapies. If you have lung cancer and you've been told it has an ALK fusion, then you're eligible for this therapy or that therapy. And that kind of testing that identifies an ALK fusion or any other kind of marker for a drug is administered by a molecular pathologist.
To get to your question as well, Mark, the pathologist, they won't tell people what is the best treatment or not, but their calls, their decisions, what they see and what they're able to find and what they're able to test for, it directs treatment in big ways and small ways and in multiple different ways. It can direct us to be like, okay, that's fine. You leave it as it is and just watch it. Or it could be like, you need to have this removed. And then the oncologist can look at the tumor markers that the molecular pathologists are able to test for and say, you're also going to need this radiation, chemotherapy, et cetera. So the information that they provide, the pathologist, that's what they do. They provide information. That information is used by different groups of doctors to then direct treatment. And it's massive. It's a massive. It is like the rate limiting step in a lot of cases, and it's the most important step. Oncologists or cancer doctors, they have this saying, "Tissue is the issue," which means that they need to have a biopsy. They need to have an answer via pathologist to know what to do, and that's where they come in. So they will help direct treatment by giving the information that the surgeon, the oncologist, in my case, the gastroenterologist will then use to make decisions. Does that make sense?
So the pathologist doesn't actually make the decision as far as course of treatment. The pathologist just says, this is what's happening right now. And whoever it is that they're reporting to is going to say, okay, now that I know what this thing is that's happening right now, I'm going to make the decision that this is what our course of treatment is going to be.
Yeah, that's basically right. We are sometimes referred to, I don't know if we're actually referred to this way or if we just describe ourselves this way, but we're sometimes called the doctor's doctor. We're essentially a consultative service that interprets the testing and the data for the doctors that are patient facing.
When you went through, but to become a molecular pathologist, you had to go through regular pathology training, right?
I did.
And then I'm assuming some specialty training to become a molecular pathologist afterwards. Is that correct?
That's true. I like how you hit the molecular every time.
Yeah, no, I want to give you your credit. What do the kids say? Give you your flowers. Is that,
yeah,
am I using
your
that
flowers
correctly? Am I saying
I think
that correctly?
So. I think so.
Okay, I want to give you your flowers, Jason, because you're pretty also, and I want to give you flowers. But I want to make sure you get that credit. As you went through this process, as you became a pathologist, I'm assuming you get the same question I get a lot. I get this from patients when they come in for a colonoscopy. I'm assuming you get this from like family members or friends you meet, like who are like have only a limited knowledge of medicine. But do you get this loaded question, which is, why did you go into this field? Why did you choose pathology? You kind of talked about it a little bit at the top of the show, but do you get that question a lot? Do you get people not understanding why you would do this? Like, I mean, there are certain types of medicine that are very sexy. You could be like, I'm a pediatric neurosurgeon, and that sounds very sexy. And then you could be like, I'm a molecular pathologist, and I don't know if people will get that. So like, do you have to explain yourself a lot?
Yeah, I explain myself a lot, and I would say about a second and a half is the average retention time of the explanation. But I do explain what I do a lot. It confuses people a lot. Some of the terminology is confusing. Like, you know, we say we're going to, or I say I run a lab, right? Because I do. But when people hear that, they think I do research. They think I'm running a research laboratory. And we don't really have a good word that distinguishes a hospital laboratory, a clinical laboratory, from a research laboratory. So that's often fairly confusing for people. I mean, to the question of how did I end up in molecular pathology? You know, like I said before, I sort of fell into pathology, fell into medicine as a backup when my research career didn't really work out. And so I sort of floundered around a bit trying to figure out what I was going to do. I ended up in pathology because it's very academic. It has a lot of similarities in many ways to a research career, you know, to a primary research career, I should say. And then when I was sort of looking for residencies, looking for a place to land after medical school, at one of my very first interviews, the chair of that department interviewed me, and she took a look at my resume, and she asked me if I had ever considered molecular pathology. And I said, of course I had considered molecular pathology. It makes complete sense for me to be doing molecular pathology.
What is molecular pathology again?
Yeah, yeah, right. And so then I went home and I looked it up. but you know, it turned out she was right. It was a good fit for me, and so I made that my mission to be a molecular pathologist.
Do you know one of the reasons I like you, Jason? You're one of the few people I've met that's like, oh, God, I fucking ended up being a doctor as my backup plan. It fucking sucks. I'm so disappointed in myself. Oh God, what a disappointment. What a failure.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie, I did feel that way for a while. Now I'm very happy. Like, I cannot say enough good things about the field of molecular pathology and how happy I am to have the job I have. I feel very lucky. It would be dishonest to say that that was always the plan. And I definitely went through a period where I was really struggling with whether medicine was something I could do. And I struggled a lot with this, with the idea of having, you know, failed basically at a research career. And I do always try to, when I'm talking to people at different stages in training, especially, I try to emphasize that, you know, just because one thing doesn't work out, it's not a disaster. It's not the end of the world. And I know you and I have talked about this before, Kaveh, that when you're in medical school, a lot of people are type A, and a lot of people are not used to failure in any form, and that does not last forever for, you know, for almost anyone. And so a lot of people in medical school and in the medical field do struggle with that idea of, you know, whether it's I failed a test, or I struggled with my board exams, or I didn't do well on a rotation, or I didn't match at the program I wanted. At the end of the day, things have a way of working out. And I'm not a big believer in karma or in fate, and I'm not a religious person by any stretch. But I do like to make sure that people understand that you can take a lot of hits you can still come out with a very, very good, rewarding career.
Did you enjoy the parts of pathology that were not directly molecular? I mean, I'm assuming pathologists do a lot of autopsies, right? My is that yeah, misconception?
Yeah, I did about 80 myself during training. I think I'm not sure what the current requirement is in training. I think it's 50. It's been gradually lowering over the years because people are not ordering as many autopsies. But yeah, I enjoyed different parts of pathology to different degrees. I think I found something to like in most parts of pathology, even autopsy. Autopsy can be really hard, I gotta say. The pediatric autopsies are tough, really tough.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
I've been moved to comment, you know, like we've been talking about this for a lot of the podcast so far, that medicine kind of writ large is like a varied enough field of human knowledge that it seems as though no matter what your personality type or what it is that motivates you, that, you know, that there's an area of medicine that is suited to your, you know, like that medicine can almost say like, oh, you're this kind of person. Good. We need people that are motivated in this particular way because we need you to do this kind of science and you're going to enjoy doing this and see things that other people will not because you are this type of person.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think in a lot of ways, that's why I've been successful in my field and why things worked out the way they did for me is because even though I didn't end up staying in a primary research field, I had a lot of experience in genetics. And I had a lot of experience in sort of just looking at genetic data and internalizing it and interpreting it before that was even a thing for medicine. And so I was sort of primed to be able to do the sorts of things that that my field demands, even though my field didn't exist yet.
Was there something that happened in medical knowledge at that particular time that made your
field a possibility?
Yeah. So the Human Genome Project was completed right around the turn of the millennium.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And that was a big deal in and of itself because it opened up a lot of avenues for understanding genetics in a way that there hadn't been before. But even beyond that, sort of like how the moon landing introduced a lot of technologies that didn't that had uses beyond traveling in space, the Human Genome Project itself introduced new ways of actually sequencing the genome quickly and cheaply that were then able to be leveraged for medicine. Those technologies have come to be called next generation sequencing, which is a terrible name, but it's kind of what we're stuck with.
I get a good sense of why you ended up in this field. I know this is impossible for you to say, like how are you supposed to psychoanalyze your colleagues, but what brings people in general to pathology, into general pathology? Because I don't remember in medical school anyone being like, I want to be a pathologist necessarily.
Yeah.
So how do people end up in pathology? Like, what is it like? By the way, I thought it was weird when people were like, I want to be a cardiologist, like day one of medical school. I was always like, how do you fucking know? Just settle down. You don't fucking know. It could suck. You might hate it. Just relax. But like, no one ever claimed at least they wanted to be a pathologist. And we've, I think, made it pretty clear, hopefully by now, how important it is. So like, how are people ending up in the field? What's bringing people to it?
I don't know that I can speak broadly about it. Taking a step back to address sort of one of the things you said, essentially everybody I know from medical school that knew what they wanted to do on day one was wrong. Like they ended up doing some other thing than what they declared they were interested in, for the most part. With respect to what kind of person goes into pathology or what makes them want to go into pathology, I think there tends to be a sort of academic interest, maybe. That might not be the right way to put it. I think people that are interested in the why of disease, this is maybe hard to explain to people that haven't been through medical school, but a lot of medicine doesn't care why. We didn't know how aspirin worked for hundreds and hundreds of years while people were still using it to alleviate pain. A lot of medicine is just, we do it because it works. And some of medicine is just, we do it because we do it. They're not even 100% sure it works. I think the people that go into pathology are interested in mechanisms. They're interested in the why of medicine. There's certainly an aspect of a nice lifestyle and, people go into different fields for all kinds of different reasons. I can't really step into anybody else's brain. But what I can say is that it's incredibly rewarding. There is an incredible diversity within the field and you can find all kinds of different things to like. It's very compatible with the rest of your life in a way that lots of fields in medicine are not. I often say that while a lot of there's a lot of data right now showing that doctors are increasingly unhappy with medicine. And statistically, that seems to be true. It does not seem to be true of pathologists. Pathologists, by and large, do seem to remain happy with being pathologists. And I'm thrilled with my career. So anybody out there that's thinking about pathology as a career, please drop me a line if you want to hear more about it. It's a great field, super rewarding.
I'm reminded of, I can't remember, I think it might have been Dr. Glaucom Flecken who might have posted this, but I'm remembering this meme that was like, or variation on a meme where it was like, somebody who's, it's like a photo of Big Bird being escorted by a bunch of Imperial, like stormtroopers, and it says, person who's planning on going into pediatrics doing a rotation for hematology oncology or something like that, it's like, I'm wondering, since we're talking about like the psychology of why you decide to go into one or another, can you think of what your what's the pathologist doppelganger, what's the opposite of a pathologist, where is a pathologist the Big Bird being escorted by?
Oh, that's a good question.
Maybe psychiatry,
because it's the exact opposite. You're like, to some degree, it's like you're not dealing with just the pure pathology, the known aspects that you can look at under a microscope. There's aspects of it that require this non-mathematical sort of approach that require sort of the just pure psyche approach,
Kaveh?
Heuristic.
Perhaps a heuristic approach. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, psychiatry is very patient-facing. It's almost definitionally patient-facing, and pathology, there are ways to interact with patients in pathology. Certainly the transfusion people do. And I miss interacting with patients. I would love to have more opportunity to do that. But we have to be honest that most pathologists do not encounter patients very frequently at all. So
living ones.
There's that aspect. And then, as you said, like, there's a certain component of, I don't want to sound dismissive of psychiatry, because I'm not. I think it's very important. It's a very important field. But there is an element of, like, once they figure out the neurological mechanism, it becomes neurology's deal, right? It's about treating patients and taking care of people empirically. It's not really always about figuring out why things are working.
There's no, if there was like a good test to be like, okay, we're going to do this serological marker to see if you have schizophrenia, like, and then once you have it, we'll give you this management, then it wouldn't be a psychiatrist. It would be something else. That's an interesting, take. I'm waiting to hear what our psychiatrist friends have to say about that, but
I'm probably going to get a lot of emails about
I was just imagining, like, Jason's description of, like, a pathologist interacting with a patient as kind of like being like Ralph Wiggum trying to start a conversation with Lisa Simpson, saying, so do you like stuff?
yeah if you ever get a call from your pathologist, that's not going to be a good conversation.
Yeah. I've never gotten a call from a pathologist who was like, hey, good news, it was benign.
Yeah.
No, it's never happened. I get the sense from talking to you that you feel like there is a very bright future in pathology, in particular molecular pathology, because it sounds like it's a relatively new field, but there's a lot of exciting things happening. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like this is sort of the frontier of new medicine?
Yeah, I do. I think there's a lot of reason for excitement and for promise in developing new treatments and a new understanding of disease. It's a little bit tricky, though, because the field has sort of grown up in a new environment of medical austerity. In contrast to sort of when radiology was booming in the 80s, when CT scans and MRIs blew up, and people were not as concerned with healthcare costs. Now there's a lot we can do with genetics and genomics, and there are a lot of potential ways to expand the field, but we're also in an environment where we're cutting reimbursement rates, where we're really concerned with ballooning healthcare costs, and so it is a challenge to be in an exciting, dynamic field where you'd like to see investment when the sort of environment is not as investment friendly as maybe other parts of medicine got to experience.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some listener questions. We have some listener questions from a couple of different places. Let's start with some of the listener questions from Blue Sky, which, okay, by the way, if you want to follow me, I am now on Blue Sky. I'm trying to detach myself from Twitter as much as possible. Here's a question from Thomas Nguyen at N-U-G-E, Nuge, at Blue Sky. I think this is probably more for coroners, but since pathologists can sometimes be coroners. So dogs and cats really eat their owners after they die. That's true, right? That's true, right?
Cats, yes. Dogs have to get really, really hungry. But cats do not care about you.
Oh, I think the whole thing with cats, the reason that they nip at you or the reason that animals nip at you is because they're trying to wake you up. Like, okay, game's over. Stop playing.
This is beyond, like, if you've ever seen the results, the consequences of this, you would know it's more than just trying to wake you up. Like, they're eating you. Yeah.
Listen, if I'm being real right now for a second, if the three of us are in a plane crash in the Andes and I'm done, I just want you to know I'm very well marbled and I hope you enjoy me. I want you guys to survive. And if you have to eat me, I'm totally cool with that. Just so you know, I'm just putting it out there.
I'm the sort of person who I value life. It annoys me when people talk about, oh, you eat hot dogs? That's like cow vaginas. So I'm just going to tell you, Kaveh, that if we're in a plane crash in the Andes, I promise we will eat all of you.
Thanks, man. I won't eat you because you're stringy. I feel like you'd be gamey. I don't know if I'd have to be really hungry to have to take some gas away.
I'm fattening myself up. I'm in the middle of my second alcoholic beverage in this one podcast. You know, that's gonna, you know, sugar, it's gonna turn into fat because I don't exercise enough.
Where do you buy your hot dogs?
the vagina, the cow vagina store. I don't know if they make them have cow vaginas. All right, here's a question from Scott Mullen, PhD. Are there day and night shift pathologists? And in a lab without windows, does it even matter? Now, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but it does raise a good question to me, which is, in terms of people who are looking for, like, you know, good work-life balance, I'm assuming you don't get called in the middle of the night that much. Am I wrong about that?
I don't. As a molecular pathologist, there aren't very many reasons to take call. There are a couple. It depends a little bit on how your practice is set up. But as a pathology resident, and certainly as a surgical pathologist or as a transfusion pathologist, we take call. One of the things that I think people outside of pathology don't exactly appreciate about pathology call is that we're on call for a whole week, and there, no matter what happens on your overnight call, you work the next day. And, you know, on average, I guess it probably evens out that you know, some nights you get no call at all and you just get to sleep, I guess. And then other nights you're up all night. But it does work a little bit differently than most other medical specialties. There's no recovery period necessarily the next day. And if you have a really bad week, that's it. You just had a really bad week. The kinds of calls that people take are frozen sections. For your non-medical listeners, a frozen section is when you're doing a surgery, if you're a surgeon and you're operating, especially if there's a concern for cancer, you will call the pathologist on call to do an immediate frozen section, look at a little piece of tissue to see if there's any tumor there. And so that's one of the big reasons to get a call. Transfusion reactions or emergency, you know, maybe there's a big car accident or a mass trauma event or something, and a lot of blood needs to be administered. That could be a call. So we do take call there, and call can be fairly burdensome. But it is somewhat different from other parts of the medical community.
Ah, okay, fair enough. I mean, you're not being called in the middle of the night to remove a hot dog from someone's throat. So I think
you mean a cow vagina?
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Exactly right. How many cow vaginas that weren't in hot dogs have been removed from people's throats in the middle of the night?
You mentioned that the number of autopsies are going down, and that people doing them.
Is that because fewer people are dying these days?
Yes.
Wait, for real?
No.
Okay, good. I was like, it doesn't feel like that.
More people are living forever than ever before.
Why are the number of autopsies going down?
I think they are undervalued. Part of it is just economics. Insurance companies don't really pay for autopsies. Nobody really pays for an autopsy. The American healthcare system, which is driven by compensation, basically, doesn't really reward doing autopsies. There's a medical legal risk aspect to it. A lot of physicians are growing ever more cautious about ordering an autopsy that then shows something that they might be liable for. There are certain basically criminal proceedings that require an autopsy. I think under some circumstances, if somebody dies of an overdose, et cetera, like there's a list of reasons when you have to get an autopsy. But medical autopsies ordered by the hospital are growing more rare. And it's too bad, because you learn a lot about the patient. You learn a lot about medicine. It's something that I think is a loss to medicine that we don't really encourage it the way it used to be.
Dude, how much of this do you feel like fear of litigation and fear of people just like, I mean, we live in a blame state, and, you know, we had a guest on here who was a pilot and trained in surgery, and he became a pilot after he trained in like cardiothoracic surgery. And he recently wrote a book, Neil Downey, and the book is about, you know, how much the world of medicine could learn from the world of, you know, the flight industry and safety. And a big part of that is like in the world of safety, like talking about mistakes, talking about things that didn't go right is like a natural, normal part of the process. And it's something you should do. And it helps protect things. And in medicine, I feel like that is changing over time. I feel like there's less, you know, I'm not in the strictly academic environment like I used to be in training, so it's hard to know. But, you know, there's the concept of the M&M, of the morbidity and mortality, where you sit down with a group of doctors, you talk about what went wrong and how to fix it. That doesn't seem to be as common a thing as it used to be, or as much emphasis placed on it and importance placed on it as I felt like it was. Do you feel like there's some component of that keeps us from doing autopsies?
Yeah, I definitely, I think there's an aversion to medical legal risk that is a component of driving people away from doing autopsies. I think beyond, you said something important, which is definitely true, that we should grapple with our mistakes. And we still do that in the hospital. There are still mortality and morbidity conferences. But the key there is that you know a mistake was made. And one of the things autopsies do is reveal mistakes may be the wrong word, but they reveal how the practice of medicine affects patients. They reveal whether, if you were operating under the assumption that a treatment was working, and the autopsy can show that it wasn't. And that's valuable information, even if it didn't directly contribute to the patient's demise. those kinds of investigations are important, and they're increasingly rare. And I agree with you. I think a lot of it is because of risk. A lot of it is also that people just don't necessarily. Medicine takes up so much time now. As well as anybody, that to add something to your plate, you know, I've got to follow up on this autopsy when nobody really is demanding it, and you're not going to get paid for it. It's a lot to ask of a person with a busy practice. So I think there are a lot of factors that play into it, but it is too bad. It's a useful exercise in medicine, I think.
This might be actually getting a little too into the weeds as far as like defining words, but I thought it was really interesting earlier when you referred to forensic pathology as, oh, those are the people that do autopsies. Because the word forensic, mm-hmm. like literally forensics is like the use of science in the process of like understanding what happened when a crime got committed. You know, and it's almost like you were like immediately drawing an equivalency of like, okay, forensic pathologists, they're the ones that do autopsies, not because forensic means, oh, we're the people that look at dead people, but like, the only time that we would look at, that we would perform pathology on a dead person would be to go, to understand what happened in a crime, as opposed to what you're talking about, which is like more educative.
Well, I don't know, maybe we should look up exactly what forensic means. My understanding of the term is more that it is, let's look it up. I'm not going to pretend.
All right, forensic.
Definitions from Oxford Languages. One, yeah. Relating to or denoting the application of scientific methods and techniques to the investigation of crime. Two, relating to courts of law.
Okay. Boom.
You got served, sucker.
I got served. All right,
baby, we know words.
It is called forensic pathology. One of their primary roles is to determine cause and manner of death, but as I was indicating in the previous discussion, they really do a lot more than that.
I could see it being used in a more general sense, which is like if there is a mystery, if it's unclear, if we're trying to figure out, like if we're trying to solve a riddle or try to solve a puzzle or a problem, I can see that.
My understanding of the term was more that it meant investigative rather than specifically related to a crime. But I will defer to
one would think all pathology is investigative, that you're not doing pathology because you think it's fun.
Yeah,
that's fun though. It is fun.
I think what I do is fun to me. I wouldn't pretend that everybody would enjoy what I do, but I think it's fun. Yeah. Well, so Merriam-Webster, not to go back and forth.
Wow, we're really doing this.
Merriam-Webster has forensic as meaning related to courts or the judiciary, but also sort of generally relating to argumentation or rhetoric. And that was sort of my understanding of how the term is applied in pathology is more
finally getting that debate on this show that people have been so richly deserving. Okay.
I didn't think we could get more esoteric and nerdy than a broad-based pathology discussion, but we've descended into competing dictionaries.
All right. It's probably a good sign for us to close up here. Jason, it was a pleasure like talking to you and hanging out. This has been our second time hanging out, you and I. I'm sorry we never got to hang out back in Berkeley. I think that would have been a lot of fun. I liked your work on the Heuristic Squelch. I'm even more impressed with your work managing this massive lab that you are doing currently and the work you're doing. If you wanted to plug something, this is the time to do it. Is there anything you would like to plug? It can be anything from your favorite deli to your Twitter account, anything you want.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not that excited about Twitter anymore. So can I anti-plug that?
Yeah, it's a real bummer. It's a real bummer these days.
Yeah, yeah. I cede my plug time to the gentleman from Los Angeles.
Mark, please tell people where they can hear you, where they can see you, and whatever else.
Jason Rosenbaum's house.
Yeah, I would love that. I would love if we could all hang out and have a beer like the old-fashioned days. But we will do that.
You guys are welcome. It's over 100 here today. So,
what's it like in L.A. right now, Mark?
Well, it's nighttime.
Yeah.
That's the answer he gave me earlier, too.
Yeah, but the audience didn't hear it because it was just me sitting here while Kaveh was going.
I asked you what the weather was, and you told me it was nighttime.
That's not weather.
It's balmy. It's nice. It was a very warm, sunny day, and now it's cool and balmy.
Well, tell people where they can find you, because I have mentioned you a ton of times on this show and your music and how much I enjoy it authentically, honestly. In fact, I was just listening to your album live at the V tonight on a road trip with my family, and loved it as always. So where can people find it and where can people hear it?
Yeah, it's actually called The Crowd at the V, which that's is a reference to one of the song lyrics that's on it.
It's not the cow V?
Wow.
That was nice. That was good.
That's some four-dimensional chess you just played on that joke.
For the comedy novices in the audience, that's what we call a callback.
That was a good one.
The Crowd at the V is available on any place that you are streaming music, Spotify, YouTube Music, Apple Music, anything like that. And it was recorded at my kind of musical living room, which is The Varnish, which is Speakeasy Style Cocktail Bar in historic core of downtown Los Angeles, where I run the music program that I am very, very proud of. So if you're in Los Angeles and you're looking for an excellent cocktail and you want to hear some good music, and it happens to be between Sunday and Wednesday, soon to be Thursday, come by and have a listen and have a sip.
I absolutely second that. I mean, even if Mark's not there, particularly if Mark is there, obviously, but it's a great place to go get a drink. It's a very cool, hip place, great cocktails. And the music, as Mark has mentioned, has been put together by his own hand. It is fantastic. It's never been bad. So highly recommend it. You guys have been amazing. Thank you to Lucky Dog Hot Sauce for the delicious hot sauces that they make that I love so much. Gentlemen, you should have received your hot sauces. Have you had a chance to try your hot sauces yet?
I'm going through it a bottle at a time. I'm not doing it. We were both sent, just for the listening audience, we were both sent 4 bottles of hot sauce. Maybe I could go through all 4 like a bit at a time, but I seem to be working through it one bottle at a time. They're delicious hot sauces. I'm very excited to go through the remainder of them. Part of me wishes that we were doing like kind of a hot ones.
Yeah.
TM, thing where like we could sit here and,
just try them.
And Rosenbaum were forced to answer questions about pathology while eating progressively spicier and more intolerable hot sauces.
It's a good idea. I'm surprised no one's done that yet. It's a great idea for sure.
Were you part of the evening in college when I was dared to drink an entire bottle of Tabasco sauce?
It wasn't just you. I think it was you and Patrick Marcassano.
I wasn't going to name people. Yeah,
edit that part.
Name that guy.
As I was in the middle of saying it, that it's like.
What's the harm of him being named like Patrick, in a dare?
I don't know. I mean, he's probably the last person that would mind. But
there were certain. This was, to my recollection, was at a Super Bowl party. I don't remember which Super Bowl, but there were
Super Bowl III, probably, given how old you guys are.
Hey,
boom!
Yes, far through the magical touchdown pass. I don't remember if it was that year or if it was a different year. Yes, I do recall the look on Jason Rosenbaum's face after having drunk a full pint glass of Tabasco sauce.
Oh shit! You did it.
Whole pint glass. Yes. Yeah. And I don't remember whether it was that year or was it a different year where our buddy Chang Ku drank.
Love that guy.
Yeah, great. Kaveh's met him.
I also have met him.
drank an entire pint of Guinness in literally 1 second. It was like he just got ready and just opened up the channel. And
oh, yeah. No, we got a guy like that on this show.
He also, by the way, this is the same dude who once at a party on a dare drank 4 pints of Guinness in 1 minute.
Wait. Can we get back?
I was there.
Hey, not Jason.
Wait. Yeah. Let's get back to the hot sauce.
Jason's that you downed.
Tell me about that. How did that go? Were you dying of reflux afterwards? Like, had you practiced that? Like, was that?
I had not practiced it. I will say that going in wasn't the problem. And you're a gastroenterologist, so you can.
Yeah, you peed it out, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Jason is a man of many exploits. I'm recalling a conversation that I had with Jason shortly after he graduated, in which he remarked, "It's amazing how much work I managed to get done as an undergrad, considering all the time that I spent watching Star Trek."
That's
all right, my friends. It was a pleasure seeing you here on this little Zoom conference call. I hope people walk away with a more in-depth understanding of pathology. I certainly have. All right, thank you guys both so much. I love you both.
If you were gonna do it, I was gonna do it.
Mm. Yeah.
I just know a lot of words. That doesn't mean I'm smart.
Yeah, when you say it's well-tolerated, Kaveh, it makes me feel like you give the same sort of speech before a colonoscopy.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready for the girl. I'm ready to save. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready to burn this fire within. Let's begin.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.